My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Walter Hagrutz, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about kind of the topic where Western countries are messing up their long-term strategies for rare earths and semiconductors. Walter, neither of us are experts on semiconductors and rare earths, but we do know what we're talking about with regards to the West. So why exactly are we talking about this topic today?
Hi Dario. Yeah, I could imagine listeners listening to this first sentence and thinking, hang on, I have to rewind to actually really properly understand what this is, what the topic for today is. It's essentially a situation where, in today's increasingly anarchical world, where you've got no longer this Western-dominated neoliberal model being imposed on everyone, but different countries fighting for power, and not just countries, also multinationals, other organizations. Fighting for influence, fighting for power without a clear geopolitical agenda. You have this enormous competition for the really important stuff. And what is the really important stuff? Well, in today's world, semiconductors, chips, rare earths, things that fuel the modern technology drive, right? The not just AI, but also all the other kind of technological advances, and you see this fight about who controls access to the foundations, the minerals, and the equipment necessary to actually produce something out of that. And that's where you see Western countries being kind of confused and not getting their strategy right. The United States, but certainly also European countries, and as we'll talk about, Australia. Countries that don't really know what they're doing at the moment because they don't have a long-term plan. And as a result, if they have any strategy, it's a failing strategy.
Yeah, it's basically the talk of the town at the moment. I mean, there's for a week we're not talking about another country attacking a country, right? We actually get to talk about almost boring things, which I would say a few years ago those were the boring things. Now, no, actually a few years ago those were the exciting things, and now they're the boring ones because we're living in such intensive times. But exactly as you said, right? The rare earths that are used to kind of produce a lot of the things that we need, right? So whether it's batteries, or any type of microchips, those are primarily sourced, but more importantly refined in China, right? So it's not that China sits on all the rare earths in the world. I mean, on a lot of them. But most importantly, that China controls the refining of them, right? So it's similarly to how we can imagine it to oil, right? Venezuela sits on the largest pot of oil in the world, but their refinement kind of platforms aren't as modern. So therefore, they're struggling a lot, kind of getting some of the best oil in the world out to the market. So that's kind of how we can think about this with regards to the rare earths in China, and also with semiconductors, right? Which we need for almost everything in today's life, whether it's phones, cars, laptops, everything is running on these little chips that are helping us run life smoothly, and they are needed for a lot of production within the West to kind of function.
A similar argument can be made about Iran, natural gas and oil. Again, they sit on a lot of it, but their refineries are just completely outdated. As a result, they struggle economically, unlike Saudi Arabia, which has the enormously high-tech kind of refineries and underneath the ground the oil to produce it. It should be pointed out that in the case of China, this situation that they find themselves in has been very much on purpose, right? It's been a very clear strategy that already started 15, 20 years ago, where China said, we need to start dominating this market. And they built the infrastructure necessary, something that other countries didn't. So it was something that China got because they looked ahead. They actually had a plan, they had a vision.
Which exactly, and interestingly, I mean, so when we're talking about these rare earths, right, we're talking about again the beginning of the supply chain. When we're talking about semiconductors from China, we're not necessarily, at least in the examples we will focus on today, talking about the best technology out there, right? So because so from my understanding on semiconductors, which is limited, I've read one book on it, but that's I think it was Chip Wars, right? I think that's what it's called. From my understanding, the best of the best semiconductors are still produced right by Taiwan, by the Netherlands, a little bolder, and by the United States. But those are the ones you need for the really advanced computers. However, the ones for phones, for laptops, for cars, it's kind of like your standard semiconductor chip, and those are mostly produced by China.
Yeah, and that has been extremely successful. Now, that also is in line with where the Chinese economy and technology is, right? So there is a little bit of a stereotype, which is these days just not correct anymore, that China just only
Outdated.
outdated. At the very minimum, outdated would suggest that it was like that in the past. There's been an part of it, but no longer, that China used to copy technology from other countries. That has been something exaggerated by the West, but it did happen, and it still to some extent happens here and there. However, Chinese manufacturing and technology developments have gone to an ex again far enough for them to have their own basis of innovation. But it's not the high-tech innovation that countries have had that had a head start from 50, 60 years earlier, right? China is still catching up. It's not a crazy idea to think that China in 20, 30 years' time will be the Taiwan of the world. By the way, this is not a political statement about Taiwan and China, just, but it's not a crazy idea that if they continue in this line, that at some point they will also be the source of the really high-tech stuff. But right now, it's still those countries, the ones that you mentioned, that had a head start and that are much more advanced in terms of know-how than the Chinese manufacturer. So it makes a lot of sense for China to say, look, we can't compete with them yet, but we can obviously produce that middle of the line, that standard kind of technology, which is where most of the demand lies, because most of the economy doesn't need the most sophisticated technology. Most of it is fine with just the things that we can produce.
And in the in the past, we've talked about how this is, of course, a completely legitimate development model, right? I mean, I remember applauding it a few episodes. Well, when I say a few episodes, by now I mean a couple of dozen episodes ago. I mean, the Chinese way was always that, hey, of course you can invest in our country, but you have to basically enter a joint venture with a Chinese company. And of course, and in my opinion, I also don't think there's anything controversial about this, that some knowledge transfer happened. Of course, you don't. I mean, that's. I don't know if this is an altruistic take, but it kind of should be in your interest to say, of course, I want to share my technology with the world, while I, of course, kind of want to stay ahead, maybe in the R&D department. So that was a completely legitimate way, and we've seen this kind of happen over the last 20 years, that China always produced that standard, middle of the line, good quality. However, the reason why I said outdated is because, again, and I've talked about this in the past, that I kind of work closely with the German industry, that the voices nowadays out of the German industry about Chinese production is no longer that attitude of, oh, they're a good production line for us and we just want them to have cheap labor for us. But no, there's a lot of like co-equal admiration about each other nowadays, that they're saying, no, the Chinese are producing in a lot of sectors just as good products as we do for cheaper, right? For less money, which again, you can discuss about what the reasons are behind this, why they're able to produce at a lot lower cost. And then in some sectors, they're also just outperforming the right. So Europe and the United States. And the one that kind of I'm closer to is, of course, solar, where when it comes to solar panels, of course, the Chinese ones are state of the art out there.
Which once again is the result of a long-term strategy. It didn't just happen by chance. It came 10, 15 years ago that the Chinese said we see solar energy as a viable future energy source. Let's invest in this and let's be world leaders. Now, as a big fan proponent of liberal democracy, I find it fascinating to point out here that this was facilitated by the political model in China, right? It was made easier, this long-term strategy, this long-term vision, when it comes to semiconductors, when it comes to solar, when it comes to car manufacturing, all those things, like this very impressive economic development model, which has gone faster than I think any other country in the world throughout history, right? It's a really impressive path from, let's say, 1980 to 2025, 45 years of enormous economic and technological growth that has been made possible by this kind of planned political system, letting capitalism do its thing, but within limits, letting foreigners invest in your country, but with a strong political system that can put restrictions on those foreigners and put demands on those foreigners, which is something that, for example, your average Latin American country finds much harder to do because they don't have the political clout domestically to impose these conditions on foreign investment. So even though I will always want to live in a liberal democracy for a lot of reasons, and this idea that liberal democracy is inherently objectively better than a state-dominated system is just shown to be incorrect by the Chinese model. It has certainly advantages that liberal democracy doesn't have.
And I mean, one of the reasons why Europe and the United States have now fallen behind in the production of solar, and right, also just the state-of-the-art technology, is because 10, 15 years ago, those sectors were a lot of times sold off to China, right? Because China had that strategic approach of, okay, we want to become world market leader in this technology. In right, in kind of liberal democracies of particularly of Western Europe, the state doesn't necessarily intervene with companies. So at that time, a lot of the companies said, oh yeah, great, a lot of money coming in from China, of course, here. Take the company, right? Take maybe also the technology. However, that's something that has changed recently. And that's kind of the reason why we're talking about this episode, because now we're seeing this, this was kind of one of the reasons why the United States has imposed sanctions and restrictions on China, is because the West doesn't want China to catch up in semiconductors, because it is seen as one of those key technologies. So both Europe and the United States are very keen on keeping the technology as far away from China as possible, with with means that are very much kind of like interfering with the market.
And here you see the problem with liberal democracy. So one of the reasons why liberal democracy could thrive in the late 20th century was because in the late 20th century, the neoliberal model was the dominant paradigm around the world. And even China had to kind of respect the basics of the World Trade Organization, global institutions, managing neoliberalism. But without that as the global world order, without that neoliberalism there, you can see that liberal democracies are basically handicapped in terms of their ability to compete with a country like China, because China can impose its will domestically and can have a long-term vision where its business has to work in a certain direction as set by Beijing, which is something that Western governments simply cannot do. And here you now run into this issue that I think was already very interesting and visible during COVID. Namely, what happened with COVID was that, okay, so here's a virus, it's very dangerous for people, people are dying. China says, we're going to do lockdown. We're going to keep people at home, we're going to close down cities, nobody go out in the street, and that way we're going to fight the virus. Then the virus gets to Europe, and Europeans see China doing that and say, okay, now we're going to do the same, because China is doing this, so we're going to implement lockdown in Italy, in Spain, and then in other countries. But of course, the problem is that in a liberal democracy, that can't work properly, because a liberal democracy is not ready for that. It doesn't have the political system to properly manage it. And you get all kinds of secondary negative side effects. You're undermining the very essence of your own society, which is something that China didn't do. Now fast forward to 2025, and you see again the United States and Europe, as you said, desperately trying to now start controlling those issues, high tech, rare earths, and all that. But the governments are not capable of doing the same that China does, because the whole system is not geared towards that. Liberal democracy doesn't allow that kind of planning mechanism by governments. And so you see a lack of genuine strategy, a lack of genuine focus, almost like a knee-jerk reaction of protectionism, which doesn't sit well with the reality of what liberal democracies are all about.
So let's talk specific examples. And the first one is the United States against China, where a few weeks ago, the United States expanded its entity list, right? So kind of like a trade restriction list that consists of like foreign personas, or like, well, persons and entities, basically limiting the Chinese access to the more advanced semiconductor chips. And in response, the Chinese said, well, okay, if you're limiting our access to your chips, then we're going to limit your access to our rare earths and our chips. Kind of causing a bit of trouble. I mean, one interesting thing is that this comes, I think next week, Trump and Xi Jinping are meeting in South Korea. So it's kind of interesting to see that posturing beforehand. I mean, if they will meet, right, with Trump, we never know whether how long these meetings will
It
last.
hasn't been confirmed yet, as far as I'm aware. There are these rumors, but nothing is confirmed, which is going to be interesting.
And it's which just shows you the craziness of this world, right? That these type of meetings need preparation, and you can't just say, "Oh, Putin and I are going to meet in Budapest," and then cancel it a week later.
Hey, can I just, you will maybe remember this, but in my foreign policy class at the university, I always insist on that these summits, traditionally, but this shows me being old-fashioned and antiquated, require months, sometimes even years of preparation. This is not just two people shaking hands. It's supposed to be about signing deals that have been prepared with all the language carefully constructed. If they do meet, it will be such a weird ad hoc event, a little bit reminiscent of Kim Jong-un and Trump meeting during his first presidency.
Yeah, that's when you told me about that, right? So that's back then when I was in your class, and I thought, oh wow, the job of a Sherpa, right? So the people kind of preparing the summit for the leaders, that might be a cool job for me, which is almost completely irrelevant in today's world, where it's just about, you know, sitting in a room together, shaking hands, making deals, negotiating the art of the deal, like. But we're getting carried away. So we basically, these are the actions we've been observing between the two countries, right? So the United States first saying, you're not going to get access to our highly advanced chips, and Chinese saying, okay, we're no longer going to give you the resources you need to produce those chips, etchy badge. And I think my tone already indicates the strategic blunder here from a US perspective, at least, because you've really shot yourself in the foot here.
It is very consistent, not just with previous actions by the Trump administration, but also with the Biden administration before Trump, right? So it comes from a attitude of almost realism in the school of realist thought in international relations, which is about absolute gains. About relative gains. I only care about whether my country does well relatively to the other country, not thinking about whether it's actually good for your country, right? So this is the difference with liberal schools of thought and others, which say, well, in the end, it doesn't really matter whether China is more powerful than you. What matters is that you, as the United States, do well, that your people are happy, that you are secure. But the realist school of thought is much more about these relative differences. You need to be at the top of the hierarchy. You need to be the alpha male, which of course fits very nicely into Trump's vision of the world as well. And as a result, it is somehow the United States has decided under Biden already, and now certainly under Trump, that China needs to be kept down. And they think they can do it with these kinds of things, not understanding that the world has moved on. The world is not interested in this fight between alpha males. It's not interested in this fight about who has the biggest economy or anything like that. It just wants to do business. And China seems to be much more aware of that and able to say, look, the United States wants to put tariffs, they want to block exports, whatever. Okay, well, I'd rather have them not do it, but we'll continue trading with the rest of the world. The United States doesn't seem to get the memo that it only weakens them in the long term.
And it's not only the United States, but it's also other countries within the Western bubble. And one of them, I mean, we've talked in the past about to what extent Australia is part of the West, but I do think that we've made a strong case in the past that Australia is certainly part of the Western bubble in a lot of elements. In this example as well, because they just struck a deal together with the United States on rare earths. Which, if you look at the globe and the position of Australia compared to the United States and compared to China, it might make more sense to maybe look towards China for a deal on rare earths if you want to be, right, not, I mean, if you want to basically have access to the biggest supplier.
Yeah, and I think there are two interpretations here. So from a US perspective, it's very clear. They want to corner the Australian production market because they want to make sure that that goes to them, that that goes to their industry. And so from the United States perspective, it's very much this geopolitical game about being the winner in the rivalry with China. In the case of Australia, I would have loved to be a fly on the wall in the conversation because there are two interpretations here. The first interpretation is exactly what you just said. It's like Australia can't help itself, but because of its cultural identity, its background, the way it views itself as Western, just dealing with the United States rather than with China, even though China makes more sense. Having said that, you could also take a second interpretation based on the current Australian government that seems to be quite pragmatic in the way they go about it. And they say, look, we'll trade with whoever is the highest bidder, right? Whereas previous Australian governments have been very, very aggressive and almost toxic towards China, which basically gave a carte blanche to the United States to do with Australia whatever they wanted. This current government seems to say, well, we've got a lot of minerals, the world wants them, who is the highest bidder will work with them. I don't know which of these two scenarios it is. I'm willing to give the current Australian government a little bit of the benefit of the doubt in the sense that maybe it's just that this doesn't, for them, is not a slight against China. It's not necessarily saying, oh no, working with the United States means that we won't work with China. It's just that it was an opportunity, they signed it, and if China wants to work with them tomorrow, they might be willing to do so.
Well, here I would be very interested in the thoughts of our Australian audience, right? Because, I mean, we've said this before, but we have a little map where we can see where people are listening from in the world. And Australia is there's always a lot of points, right? Little individual listeners that kind of group together to bigger points and bigger bubbles. Australia is always one of the countries that is nicely represented. So here, Australians or non-Australians living in Australia, send us your interpretation.
Absolutely. I think there's no doubt that Australia suffers from the Western bubble elements that are so clear in Europe and North America. It just seems to me that somewhere in the current government, there are some advisors that have woken up to this and that seem to maybe be willing to listen. However, you have to, as Australia, understand that the moment that you work with the United States, you do pay a price for your ability to work with China, right? And vice versa. And that's the problem that Australia has created for itself because it is seen as such an agent of the Western bubble that China will not fully trust any connections with the United States. Whereas if you look at any other country in the region, if you look at, I don't know, Malaysia or Indonesia, if they work with the United States, that will not necessarily trigger warning signs for Beijing, because Beijing will say, well, of course they will work with anyone. But in the case of Australia, Australia has to still prove to China kind of that it's an honest broker and that they aren't some kind of secret agent infiltrating Southeast Asia for Western motives.
Well, another country that's in need of good advisors, maybe similarly to the ones for the Australian government, is the Netherlands, Balder. And I'm only saying your name because it's obviously your country, and so you have to answer to everything the country does, right? It's one of those feelings that students always have in class, right? Whenever the professor talks about your country, you can feel everyone looking at you, and then you having the urge to justify actions of a country and of a government that you might not even agree with. But so you have to go through that experience now. Because a few weeks ago, the Netherlands invoked and this is so picture perfect for the Western bubble. The Netherlands invoked a Cold War era law to take effective control of the company Nexperia, a semiconductor company in the Netherlands, because they had concerns, the United States had concerns about the Chinese owner, Wingtech, kind of stealing the knowledge and the technology. And that, unfortunately, is kind of leading to disruptions, because then China said, okay, then we will no longer send chips to you, which has alarmed the European car industry, saying that the battle between the Netherlands and China over the control of Nexperia could hit production factories very soon. And I should add that Volkswagen has denied this, but Volkswagen is shutting down two plants for production plants here in Europe for a week, kind of saying that this was planned long time ago because of vacation. But yeah, it seems like that Europe really shot itself in the foot here.
Yeah, when you say European car industry, you really mean German car industry mostly, because they were the ones that were most outspoken about this, if we're gonna name nationalities here.
Yes, one second, sorry to interrupt you there. It is mostly, of course, German car manufacturers because those are the biggest ones in Europe, but I would say it's European production plants because Nissan and some others, they are also concerned about the lack of semiconductors coming to Europe.
Right, of course, I'm half kidding, but it is very clear that politically it's the Germans who are shouting out the loudest at the moment. By the way, I did read just this morning, but maybe you've got updated information that Volkswagen has said that they're keeping things open next week. So they've w withdrawn some of their statements, but we'll see what happens.
I would not be surprised if there was a certain element of political pressure involved here.
Right, exactly. So we'll see. But the main point here is absolutely correct. So the Netherlands does this, and this goes also back to the point I made earlier, namely that not just how perfect it is that this is using a law from the Cold War era, which was of course focused on containing any technology going towards the Warsaw Pact, towards the Soviet Union or East European countries. But it also demonstrates how badly this works if a liberal democracy tries to do it, because it's been quite a kind of a disastrous attempt by the Dutch government. They presented it as a way to save chips for the European market. They said, we are concerned that if we don't do this, then too many chips will be exported to China, because in 2019 this Chinese company bought the company, and we want to protect our European partners. Whereas now we can see that those European partners are actually panicked because of this very step by the Netherlands, right? It is just not possible for a liberal democracy to have this kind of behavior effectively. It doesn't work within the system if you don't have a broader structure, a broader vision of how, when, and why. And this kind of ad hoc decision making by the way, a government that shouldn't be making any decisions because they have fallen and there are new elections coming up, is exactly the kind of thing that liberal democracies in the West in general are struggling with, right? It's incompetence based on a system that doesn't allow to do what China does all the time.
Yeah, it very much is. And before this episode, I think we spent about 10 minutes trying to perfect an anecdote. No, not an anecdote, like a comparison to the situation. And it took us quite a while because sometimes I throw out these crazy comparisons and they don't work. But we in the end managed to come up with again a playground, right? The school playground comparison, which I really enjoy when we do that. And so I remember, and today we're going back a lot to the classes I took with you, that in 2018 and 19, you were the first one that I've kind of learned about the wolf warrior diplomacy from the Chinese toward the Euro towards the West towards Western diplomats, right? So this was Chinese diplomats acting overly confident and overly aggressive in international organizations, right, on the world stage, and really rubbing Europeans and Americans the wrong way, kind of creating an anti-reaction. And what I compared this to is this new kid on the block, right? So who has kind of new money, he's moving into a new school, he arrives at the school with like his cool outfit, and is aggressively trying to show off and flash his wealth to, right, and invite people to his party, kind of being confused why no one looks at him because there's the actual cool kid, and that was the United States, right? With I don't know, a nice watch, a nice car, inviting everyone over for a party on the weekend. That was seven, six, seven, 8 years ago. With this situation, right? So the West kind of rubbing China in the wrong way and really overplaying their hand, if you ask me, on semiconductors and rare earths, right? As we see with both examples, shooting themselves in the foot. It is almost like in the last few years, that original cool kid, the United States, like bullied a freshman, right? Like pushed him into a puddle, and everyone and thought it was cool. And everyone looked at them like, "No, that's not really cool. What are you doing? Why are you being so mean?" While in the meantime, that new cool kid, aka China, realized that maybe it overplayed its hand. It didn't really understand the vibes, and is now just an actual cool person. who is now annoyed by the old cool kid trying to, right, kind of bully himself back into the positive light by everyone. Because why, Walter, why is it that Europe and the United States, in such a topic where they obviously don't have any leverage, are just pushing China until they cause a reaction, and China says, "Well, okay, now you've annoyed me long enough, go away. I'm the cool kid now. I'm gonna hit you with the same measures that you hit me with, but they're actually gonna hurt you, not me."
The analogy might still need a bit of perfecting to get it quite right, but
The listeners will understand me, I'm
maybe we
sure.
can do a competition. Who figured out exactly what Dario's analogy was all about?
Maybe someone could draw a picture.
A cartoon. We'll publish it on, wherever we can publish it. The main idea is absolutely right. The answer is personal insecurity, right? So China, about 10, 15 years ago, was still very much insecure about its position in the world, and it was desperate to be liked by the world, to be respected by the world. That's where your analogy really works very well. And the United States already had this enormous advantage. And so China desperately trying to demand respect led to bad outcomes. That insecurity led to China behaving in a way that actually had a counterproductive result, namely people respecting China less, being annoyed with China, etc. Now in 2025, it's very obvious that United States and European countries are the insecure ones. They are the ones who are not really sure anymore about who they are, whether they are still respected, whether what their future looks like, whether they're gonna have a career after they graduate. It's very unclear for the West who they are and where they're going, whereas China has now found that confidence and as a result does not have to play those fragile ego games anymore. They've got their ego, they know who they are, and that's it. And so the tables have turned, absolutely, in that sense. And as a result, the West starts doing crazy stuff, whereas China just has a long-term strategy, just walks on, doesn't get too distracted. Now, having said that, and we've said this in many episodes before, China does have serious issues, challenges that are at the moment unresolved. My prediction is certainly not that China is going to be a global dominant hegemon over the next 20, 30 years, because there are too many internal weaknesses within China. But at the international stage, they have found their stride. They have found their identity. And they don't need to prove anything anymore. Whereas it's now the West that is trying to prove its power, prove its influence, prove its likability, and it's just not working for them. And then you have these crazy things like the Netherlands doing this with the chip maker, and it's just a little bit pathetic. It's just bad, and leads to stupid outcomes that anyone with half a brain could have seen coming. And again, I want to go back to that analogy of COVID. It was completely obvious that lockdown for European countries wasn't going to work well. It was going to lead to bad outcomes. But they did it because they thought if China does it, then we should do it. And that's exactly what you see now with economics happening as well.
So what should the West do instead? I mean, what would be the correct behavior here? I mean, I assume it's along the lines of don't try to, right, so don't bite the hand that feeds you when it comes to semiconductors. Anything else?
Well, I mean, so it's difficult, right? Because, like I said, the fundamental problem that the West has is something that is not easily solved, namely its own domestic structure. Its liberal democratic framework works if the globe, if the world order is also neoliberal, if the world order facilitates that identity. But without that world order, the danger for liberal democracies is that they're going to be overshadowed by more authoritarian regimes that can actually plan ahead. That there is a very lively conversation that fluctuates between economics and politics in the West about how many goods should be earmarked as strategic, right? Because there is a long tradition for any country throughout the modern era of having certain goods that, when they are earmarked as such, strategic goods, security sensitive issues, that the government can actually, for example, prohibit mergers or takeovers. So you could argue that the Netherlands in 2019 should not have allowed a Chinese company to buy up this and say this is a strategic good. No foreign entity should buy this company. Yes, we're a liberal democracy, but some security issues override that identity. However, that's not what the Netherlands did. They let it happen, and now they're desperately trying to bend the system in ways that it can't be bent. So the one thing that, as an advisor to the Dutch government, I could say is, okay, maybe you should think carefully about what you believe are the strategic goods that you need to defend in a increasingly competitive and nasty world order, and make sure that foreigners don't take hold of them, don't control those. That's, you know, but that is a difficult conversation because, again, it touches on that identity of liberal democracy.
Well, and that's a conversation that you need to have years ago. But if you are in today's world, then I mean, and you failed at making that that assessment, right? So you hopefully had a risk assessment in 2019, thinking about what might the world look like, right? Do I need? I mean, traditionally, we think about energy, we think about mainly military of things, okay, that are strategic, that need to be earmarked. The West didn't think about semiconductors, or at least didn't take it serious enough. So what do you do today? Then you basically have to kind of give in to China, right? And make sure that on semiconductors, you don't rub them the wrong way. Or does this go back to something we've discussed at the beginning of the season, where you can't give in to the bully, right? Because China at some point is going to realize that this is like the West's Achilles heel, and that it can kind of always say, hey, if you don't do this, then I'm going to cut off your semiconductor.
Yeah, in the case of Europe, this is slightly different than the United States. I have a hard time thinking of China as a bully. Not, I mean, they are a very powerful nation, and they obviously try to get their way. There's no doubt about it. But in terms of the Netherlands and their behavior over the past couple of weeks towards China, it's the Netherlands who breaks the rules, right? So the argument is that if you want to be somehow consistent with your identity of liberal democracy, yes, you can earmark certain sectors, certain goods as strategic, as security sensitive. Absolutely. But that has to be a rule that is set in advance, not retaliatory against China in this case, but just a rule that applies for that sector with respect to everyone. If Belgium or Germany want to buy it, the Netherlands could also say no. Or maybe you say, okay, with the EU it's different. Then if the United States or Canada want to buy it, you say, no, sorry, this is a strategic good. You can't control this. But the way that it now works is that the United States and European countries all of a sudden notice that there's a problem somewhere, in this case with chips, and they just take some drastic action based on the idea, oh no, the Chinese are coming. We need to protect against the Chinese. Which means that, of course, that's going to ruffle the feathers of the Chinese. The Chinese are going to be annoyed by that, obviously, because they feel unfairly targeted, because they are. And secondly, you become an unreliable partner for anyone else in the world. Now, the United States has as a broad strategy to still have this kind of geopolitical fight with China. Europe should stay completely out of this fight. Europe, we've said this in the past, needs to have a vision where they say, we are a continent that can do business with everyone. On our terms, we've got certain principles, we've got certain values, we've got certain rules about doing business with us. But as long as you respect those rules, rules that are the same for everyone, we are open to work with you diplomatically, politically, economically, financially, etc. And that requires Europe to change its tune and stop seeing itself as this Western identity that is somehow desperately fighting against evil dictators around the world, and instead see itself as a continent that is never going to rule the world anymore. That is 300 years too late for that. But they can play a major role in global dynamics, positively, constructively, without playing the silly alpha male toxic game that the United States is playing.
This seems like a great moment during today's conversation. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com. We will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side, Walter. Which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I have a quote that is not so much about the West itself, but more about the world that we are heading into. It's a quote by Jeremy Bentham, of course, the political author, British author, who has written many amazing books and is very quotable. And this is about the fact that the world order is now no longer following a specific agenda. It is becoming chaotic, it's becoming anarchical, it's becoming unpredictable. And that is something that should scare all of us to a certain extent, and we should try to think of ways to avoid that scenario. And the quote goes, "Tyranny and anarchy are never far apart."